Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're talking about high-speed rail in California with Margaret Sederoth. She is the Director of Planning and Sustainability for the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Margaret, welcome to the podcast. It's great to meet you.
Thank you, Ted. It is wonderful to meet you.
And I've already introduced you as the Director of Planning and Sustainability for the California High-Speed Rail Authority. And I don't want to go too far into your background, but you grew up in Illinois. How on earth did somebody from Illinois who studied Eastern history ended up in this position at the California High-Speed Rail Authority?
Ah, that is a great question. And the short answer is, we're all shaped by our parents. And I think my first degree was shaped by my mother, who, was focused on history and was a librarian. My second degree, which is a master's of urban and regional planning, was shaped by my father, who ran a lumberyard. He was a draftsman and an architect and really helped hone my sense of how to look at the built environment, how the built environment gets stood up, what it does for communities. And in my career journey, I was always very hungry to explore other places and other parts of the world. And so I took my urban planning degree and had the good fortune to work within a global engineering firm, Parsons Brinckerhoff, and to work with really wonderful mentors who took, kind of a risk on an urban planner with this broad, broad set of interests and really profound interest in shaping our infrastructure to be much more in service to our communities, much greener, to really be sustainable infrastructure, and helping introduce me to opportunities around the world. And in that journey, I've worked in a couple of places that, there's a bit of a through line of sustainable infrastructure and renewable energy focuses that led me to my current position here in California on the California high-speed rail system.
Well, how great. And part of along the way, you worked in Tunisia, right? Or you had a...
I did some graduate work in Tunisia. And I can recall lots of, getting introductions to people. And I think my interest there was in like social housing and the nexus to transportation and what happens when you move people too far away from their jobs. And there's a gender component to that. And Tunisia was a wonderful place to work, actually really amazing culture and tremendously generous, interesting people.
Before we get into the sustainability aspects of the high-speed rail, and I mentioned this to you earlier, that there's this perception in California amongst, I think, very knowledgeable people that high-speed rail, the whole high-speed rail project is dead or it ain't happening. And I listened to your seminar that you put on at Stanford several months ago, and I would just say it's happening in a very big way, in a very solid way. The state has a huge commitment to this project.
Yes, California High-Speed Rail could not be more happening. It could not be more alive. There are more than 1,300 people who show up every day, put on their hard hats, and are constructing high-speed rail across 113 miles in the Central Valley. We've built dozens of structures, some of which are more than a kilometer long. You can see the construction of high-speed rail in Google Earth if you just take a gander at construction going on between, roughly the Madera County and then down toward Wasco. And you will see, the alignment coming to shape, which we've graded and cleared or we've built structures on. And it is, I laugh because you've put your finger on what the more than, 200 people who work for the state of California on this program, the more than 300 consultants who support us in the design and the engineering and the program management of this program that, our running joke is you go to a cocktail party, you go to a dinner party, you talk to your relatives and they say, well, I thought that project died.
Yeah. And it did die in other states. Weren't there a number of states that were vying for these federal funds? I think there was a project north of Chicago, maybe heading up towards Milwaukee, and there was another project in Florida. And it seems like have all of those other projects sort of fallen off, and we're the sole federal project now?
Oh, great, great recall from back to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was, you know, back in 2008, this large slug of federal dollars that went to a kind of a new national high-speed rail program. And, you know, several states were awarded grants. It was a competitive grant program. You know, the High-Speed Rail Authority put in an application to initiate work on a few different segments in California, and the Central Valley segment was selected. Texas received some funding, Wisconsin, Florida, and, you know, due to more locally based politics, some of that money was handed back to the federal government, which California said, thank you very much. We can put that to use. Work.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
And we have, you know, that first slug of federal cash came at a fantastic time for the program. We had passed Prop 1A, which is the enabling legislation that really grounded the foundations of high-speed rail, right? Operate at 220 miles an hour, which is true high-speed rail, be fully grade separated, passenger rail running on electricity. And those characteristics that were part of a ballot initiative back in 2006 that, you know, the Californians voted on provided $9 billion, yep. which was, yep. you know, about a quarter of the funding we would need for the full system. The next chunk of money from the federal government, you know, allowed us to really start to understand and shape how we could do a test track that funded very specifically a test track in the Central Valley to deliver proof of concept really for the United States that you could have truly high-speed rail service, dedicated passenger rail on its own standalone alignment. And we, you know, just over a few beats there, we then also, thanks to the hard work of the Brown Initiative and the cap and trade program that got set up in California, there was another tranche of funding that provided an ongoing source of funds for the High-Speed Rail Authority.
Let me back you up just a little bit. This is great stuff. And I think the whole system is intended to be about 500 miles. Is that correct?
Yes.
The network?
True.
And would run all the way, would run all the way from San Diego all the way up to Sacramento. There'd be a spur out towards the Bay Area.
Right. Great, great homework on high-speed rail. We actually have phase one and phase two. So phase one is dedicated passenger rail between San Francisco and Los Angeles, Anaheim, taking a swoop through the Central Valley so that you're connecting the major population centers of the state. Phase two takes you from Merced to Sacramento and then from Los Angeles over to San Diego. And we don't yet, we've done some of that initial, you know, planning level work back in the aughts on phase two, but for the past decade, more than a past decade, our enabling legislation and funding sources have had us focus on phase one, and then within phase one, even tighter on an initial operating segment between Merced and Bakersfield.
Right. And then all told, I think I've been able to deduce this by something that you said. You said that the $9 billion of seed funding that came from the bond measure in 2008 was about a quarter of the total cost of the entire system. Did I hear you correctly?
As we had estimated the time. And yes, I think everyone appreciates how, you know, early estimates that are based on, you know, really high level planning studies are very different to what emerges as you dig into project specific segments, as you do geotechnical analyses in the areas where you are building, or as you complete environmental documents. And in that highly consultative, incredibly important process, you identify the need for mitigation or the need to maybe move the alignment slightly or tunnel through a section. And so once you start doing that more detailed engineering work,
it's going to go up.
It does. You get much
you started off at maybe 36 million and maybe it goes to 50 or 60 or 70, or we don't even know, but.
We do. We have a really good estimate. It's in our business plan that, we just published in February of 2023. We will be taking a proposed final document to our board of directors on April 11th. And in it, every 2 years, we, as part of our requirements, report to the legislature our business plan for the program, which has updated capital cost estimates in it.
What is it now, approximately?
You know, we are in that $100 billion
range,
which, you know, is, you know, we've done some grounding of that cost with other high-speed rail segments and other places like HS2 in the UK and other European segments, and we have about the same cost per mile. It just, I think we are unaccustomed in the United States to this level of kind of audacious investment in infrastructure. We don't have the memory of the people who stood up the Highway Trust Fund and focused on the highway expansion across the United States. Now we're on the cusp of, you know, a rail revolution and looking to making investments in rail infrastructure and coming to terms with what it means to stand up that level of infrastructure and the costs of that infrastructure. But then also the value and the benefits of that infrastructure.
I was going to say the benefits are just enormous. We'll talk more about them. I wanted to focus just one quick question, because I'm sure listeners are going to be wondering, how is Fresno? You described Fresno as the epicenter of high-speed rail in California because you're doing that test track out there. How was that selected as the starting point?
Well, it was in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act had a competitive grant program for rail systems. And so we presented the case of three different segments. And, you know, for many reasons, I think the Central Valley segment was selected. I think the thinking at the time was, this is a great level area. You don't have to go through mountains. You don't have to, we do have to span rivers and waterways, and we do have to navigate, you know, getting into downtowns like Fresno, Merced, and Bakersfield. But relatively speaking, it kind of looks a little bit easier to get enough track laid to have a test track, right? We all, laws of physics, we need 119 miles to test the system at speed. I think it also, if you think about what was happening in the global economy at that time, you know, there was a lot of unemployment, greater unemployment and less economic recovery happening in the Central Valley than in other places. I think in part because of the way the economy has historically been structured there. So high-speed rail as a public sector investment brought to the table a large swath of construction activity, which, you know, we understand how infrastructure serves our economies relative to boosting economic activity and providing great living wage jobs for, you know, construction workers who were otherwise, you know, we've got a lot of fantastic content on our website and interviews with construction workers who said, you know, previously I had to drive to LA. That was where the big construction market was, or to the Bay Area, you know, and I never got to be home for my kids' ball game, or I couldn't, you know, I was spending so much time driving to my job. Now I can show up to high-speed rail. Like, this is my job in my backyard. People are really proudly building the infrastructure to serve their communities and their children's future.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had read that you had already had 5,500 jobs and serving 192 disadvantaged businesses. But I think Micah told me that it was more like 12,000 jobs already. So this is growing really fast. Let me ask a clarifying question about the state mandate. Is it right that the state mandate required a rail system that would get from LA to San Francisco in a certain amount of time, or was it less than 3 hours?
No, you are 100% correct. The Prop 1A, our enabling the bond act that really provided that first source of funds and then was put into code, specified travel times. And, you know, it was at the time a very clear choice by people who were standing up that act, because what you were offering people very clearly was a mode of travel that gave you the same travel time door to door really as an air trip, but doing that without the environmental penalty of flying or driving. And so by making sure they had baked in that travel time competitiveness, they were baking in the kind of creating that that positive pressure around ridership, right? People will get out of their cars if they can take a fast train.
Yep. Yep. And forget about, and not have to worry about the weather. And I right. commute from Burbank to Oakland a lot. You know, I've been there.
Oh. You've lived it.
Yes, it's nice when everything is functioning smoothly. It's very nice. Let's shift to sustainability and your job with sustainability. And, you know, when I think about high-speed rail, I told you I'm a big train buff. I mean, trains mm-hmm. are just inherently sustainable, right? They're, mm-hmm. you know, they're enabling this mode shift from cars and mode shift from planes. So trains are just inherently sustainable. But your agency or your authority has set up, you know, just remarkable goals, like the goal of creating the greenest infrastructure project in history. I'm proud of you all. How did that all come about, that sustainable vision being part of this?
I think its roots rest within California as this incredibly rich policy area for creating sustainability and delivering something with that lens of environmental quality, making sure people are taken care of, making sure it makes economic sense, right? The sort of three big pillars of sustainability. I think if you look at, as I mentioned, if you look at our bond act, you see that the choice was really about mobility and economic development, right? Delivering that classic sustainability thing. How do we, you know, meet the needs of today's people without sacrificing the future? Mm-hmm. So great. How do we enable economic development and sustainable development without sacrificing environmental quality? So it's a little bit almost encoded in our DNA, right? It's just a part of our fabric and our bones. But what I saw, you know, when I was asked first to do some work on a renewable energy strategy back in 2010 on the project, you know, it was incredibly clear that the leadership of our board of directors and our executive team were a reflection of those sustainability values that kind of inhere in California at large: transparency, accountability, sustainability. But then I've also witnessed the effect of leadership on allowing us to set and meet audacious goals, like operating the system entirely on renewable energy, or, you know, putting real substance and integrity behind this concept of, you know, it is lovely to say, oh, let's go be the greenest infrastructure project. Let's be a model of rail infrastructure. But what I found in putting this in motion with a team of incredibly smart, dedicated people here at the authority is, you know, California means it and the authority means it. Our board of director really means it. We don't just have a policy on sustainability. We have specifications. We have contract terms. We do intense monitoring of what our contractors are doing in construction now so that we can meaningfully demonstrate that the way we've approached the delivery of the project is moving the needle on business as usual behaviors around waste, around the use of cleaner equipment, around the use of cleaner materials, and then how we engage with the labor force and use small businesses and targeted workers.
Well, so it sounds fantastic. I mean, I love what you said about it. It's in our DNA as Californians. It's in our DNA. And then you praise your leadership, which is fantastic. And I always, you know, you always run into the marginal cost. You know, there's a marginal cost of going green, or traditionally there's been a marginal cost of going green. And so somehow your leadership has been able to absorb that, accept that, and see the bigger, the co-benefits that we were talking about, all the indirect benefits to economic development and health and vitality of the state, and leadership that might lead us to projects in other states. And mm-hmm. they see the vision.
They do see the vision. I have to say, you've asked my favorite question, because okay, I've been in sustainable infrastructure for more than two decades, right? I've worked on many different types of mega projects and have worked to deliver various components of them. And, you know, when it comes to that sustainability question, you always get the, oh, well, no, clearly it's going to cost more. You know, I think Governor Newsom's leadership is crystal clear on the fact that you can deliver audacious, very bold climate actions and still have the fourth largest economy in the world, right? There are things California is doing relative to climate action and sustainability that, you know, really show you it it's the way to move forward. It's a way of growing up a range of new economies, and it's, you might pay a slightly larger premium from a capital perspective, but from a life cycle cost perspective, and then from those co-benefits perspective, you're more than breaking even. It's really a no-brainer. And then we've been very conscious of cost on high-speed rail. The team that I work with are really smart about making sure they do that analysis when we're looking at new policies and new strategies, like our zero emissions vehicle strategy. You know, there's a fantastic kind of context that we sit within in California, and the focus on zero emissions vehicles across all scales of vehicles. So the industry, the market is there, but we've also seen that, you know, if you look at the cost for, you know, travel relative to diesel compared to electricity, and then if you have to pay an offset, it just makes more economic sense overall to be approaching things with this greener lens or this sustainability lens.
It's really fantastic. I guess by mandate, 100% of the power that runs the system will be renewable. And then during construction, you have a mandate of zero emissions, right? Or net zero emissions during construction. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the preservation of habitat. Have you been dedicated like strips of land or rights of way? And therefore you have all this land that you can then preserve in terms of habitat? How does that work?
Oh, what a great question. You know, acquisition of right of way is kind of, you know, like that's this, the, if you picture a duck on a water, sort of the feet moving very fast are our right of way team, acquiring right of way for the build out of the infrastructure. But, you know, as we've done that, we've again made very clear commitments to, through our environmental documents or through other documents as well, that say, okay, when we're, you know, needing to acquire a piece of agricultural land, and, you know, high speed rail can't wiggle through the state of California. We need to go very straight. We need to make very smooth curves in order to maintain those 220 miles per hour speeds. Mm. You know, to do that, we also recognize we then bear a commitment to make sure we're acquiring adequate mitigation parcels. What I, you know, cherish about my colleagues in the environmental mitigation space is that they thought very critically about not just doing, you know, sort of piecemeal or one-off little bits, but aggregating what they do so that they could do landscape level habitat restoration or conservation easements, or make sure we get a conservation easement adjacent to another easement so that you start to really maintain and protect a whole ecosystem as well. So, you know, we also are, you know, now that we have been, again, we're in construction across 119 miles. We have another 18 to go in the south and 20 to go in the north to complete the 171 miles of the first operating segment between Merced and Bakersfield. You know, as we've been doing that, we do see that we have parcels that are very well configured to do some pretty interesting things when it comes to operating the railroad. And, you know, one lens that gets applied to the land assets that we have is, can they serve as mitigation? Can they serve as a kit fox habitat? You know, how are they of service to the ecosystems in which we are building? And also, how can they be of service to reducing the operating costs of running a 220 mile an hour high-speed rail system? And that goes back to the question you were starting about running the system entirely on renewable energy. Again, our board set this truly audacious goal in 2008 to run entirely on renewable energy. And, you know, our first crack at that topic, you know, it was really inefficient to think about, you know, like lining the alignment with solar panels, and then you think maintenance and the loss of power across that long line of distribution. Losses. Right. Yeah, a lot of transmission losses. So we're like, no, that's not a great idea. Let's look at clever ways of approaching power purchase agreements and, you know, other authorities relative to our purchasing power and contracting. But then, you know, in 2016, NEM 2.0 actually opened up this really interesting window for a while around the opportunity to do behind the meter systems at scale. And that's where I got to work really closely with Rick Brown and his incredibly talented team at Terra Verde to analyze these very well configured parcels that we had when we were doing acquisition for the system. We were left with, you know, sometimes 100 plus acre parcels because they were, you know, the farmer or the landowner could no longer use them the way they wanted to. So we had those parcels, and we find that, you know, with those parcels for generation in proximity to where we take the power from the grid, our traction power substations, we have this opportunity for a novel resilience element for the system that allows us to operate entirely on renewable energy. So generate, you know, more than 45 megawatts of renewable energy, tie that to battery storage, draw off of that battery storage, particularly during peak moments, so that we're reducing our overall cost of electricity, and then have a source of backup power for when the grid is feeling stressed during our extreme heat moments in the summer.
Very important. You know, we have just a few more minutes left. I want to make sure I'm just trying to think what listeners would be questioning. If I'm in the Bay Area, what is, because you mentioned the test track out in the valley and how the progress there. And I read also that you've got 422 miles of environmental clearance of these 500 miles. But you're working on the entrance to the Bay Area, San Francisco, and you're working on the entrance. Can you just talk about each of those portals for a few minutes?
Oh, of course. So what's interesting is you say, like, oh, is high-speed rail dead? No, alive and well, and in your backyard, because we helped provide about $700 million of funding to the Caltrain Electrification Program. And that is set to deliver this fall. Right, electric trains running on the Caltrain corridor. That is reducing noise, reducing pollution, improving safety, improving travel times. So that investment is kind of a make-ready investment for the future high-speed rail operation. In the South, we actually funded.
And Margaret, let me just interrupt you for a second. So that means that we're going to be able to use the Caltrain's tracks.
Yes.
The tracks into San Francisco are already there. You're just going to be using them. Is that the same coming into LA?
So in LA, it's the Metrolink system. And in LA, we are planning to build our own operating right-of-way until roughly kind of the Burbank area. And then we'll be sharing some space with Metrolink. But what's transformative about the investment we're making sort of between Bakersfield and Palmdale, or what we will make when we get funding to be able to make that investment, is taking, you know, Bakersfield, Palmdale, Burbank, you know, that is now a 2 hour plus journey by car. Just Palmdale to LA alone is about an hour and 45 minutes of commuting time in the morning with it, that 80,000 people are doing. Yeah. And the train journey is a fairly slow Metrolink journey. So we'll be creating a dedicated rail link between those cities that cuts your travel time down to, you know, roughly 45 minutes, 60 minutes between Bakersfield down LA and just Palmdale to Los Angeles will be about 25 minutes. It's transformative. We almost can't even fathom. It's kind of like when we went from walking to riding horses, and then when we jumped from horses to the first train sets, like that was a transformative jump in our
right.
mobility.
Right. And I was also interested that in the valley, you're also doing all sorts of underground rail crossings. And those, of course, have always been a source of a problem.
Yes.
People are waiting in traffic jams because the trains are going by and accidents occurring. So there's a lot of infrastructure development going on throughout the system.
There is. I'm actually really pleased you pointed that out, because we do get quite a lot of questions. I think you pegged it, like, why do things take so long? And why is it so expensive? And, you know, we aren't just building high-speed rail, we are also, as you said, there's more than 50 grade separations happening in the Central Valley. So we're either taking people up and over the train or under. And that, or we're building these major structures that also carry freight rail as well. Those grade separations are expensive to undertake. They take a lot of time. But to your point, the value for communities is tremendous. You know, not to have a set of idling cars in your backyard or stretched out along a highway, and to enable that mobility in these rural areas is incredibly important.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Hey, listen, I could talk to you all afternoon, but let's do it again. We'll do an update in a certain number of months. Thank you so much for your time and for what you're doing for the state of California. It's just fantastic.
Thank you, Ted. It was wonderful to get to talk to you, and I'm thrilled that people will be learning more about the project.
Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.